he had aimed it at the sun at a certain point, so like the lens was burnt out on it. Yeah, but I mean, but shortly after that, I got a job at a horse ranch, shoveling horse shit and feeding racehorses. And that money that I made that summer is what paid for my first video camera, and I've been making movies ever since.
Horror Movie Survival Guide is a weekly podcast where I, Gorehound Julia Marchesi, delves into my horror movie notebook to corrupt another one of my longtime chums, Terry Gamble, who is hiding in the creepy horror closet.
My mission is to learn the gospel of horror movie survival and to incorporate Julia's wealth of wisdom to become a final girl disciple.
Join us as we take a deep dive into everything from OG horror
to newly released films,
but prefer the classics on VHS.
We'll talk about obscure details that no one else notices.
Spin off into alternate casting universes, crush on some dodgy, foxy fellows,
and creepy uncles, and arm ourselves with the knowledge necessary to become the final girl.
Hey guys, welcome to Horror Movie Survival Guide. I'm Terry and
I am Julia. Hello everyone out there. We are so excited today. Terry, tell us who we have.
Oh my gosh, we have another wonderful interview and I am like over the moon because I've been obsessed with this filmmaker for quite some time. We have Lucky McKee. He's a filmmaker who burst onto the scene with his 2002 cult horror film, May, and has since directed such awesome films as The Woman, which we have covered here on our show before, All Cheerleaders Die, and The Woods. He has also contributed segments to the horror anthologies, Master of Horror and Deathcember, which we also have covered on this show, and Tales of Halloween. And he has written the books I'm Not Sam and The Secret Life of Souls. And his film career continues with the brand new 2022's Old Man. Welcome to Horror Movie Survival Guide, Lucky McKee. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, yes. I'm like so pumped. So cool. The Woman's like one of my favorite movies. So like, I'm just going to say that up top. I'm just like been thinking about this movie forever. So I'm happy to have you here to talk about that and your whole career with us.
Okay. Let's get into it.
All right. Well, let's, as anyone shall, begin at the beginning. So let's talk about when you fell in love with cinema and horror cinema. I don't know if they became concurrent. Sometimes not. Sometimes yes.
You know, I grew up in a very, very, very rural environment, very much in the middle of nowhere in a house, you know, on 5 acres next to another person that had a house on 20 acres next to, you know,
wow.
Not a lot going on around. So, you know, to get to go to the movies was a very special thing. I mean, when I, you know, probably until the time I was about 10 or 11 years old, I mean, I would maybe see one movie a year in a movie theater.
What?
And wow. If we were lucky, and it was a very special thing. I mean, it was, as far as my sister and I were concerned, it was like getting taken to Disneyland to get to go to a movie. It was a really, really special thing. So
can you remember some of the ones you saw?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first movie I can remember seeing was at a drive-in. I saw Jaws.
Okay.
I was about 3 years old. And then I remember seeing Star Wars at that early age and you know, a lot of the stuff that we would end up, you know, if we did go see one movie in a year, it was usually a Lucas, Spielberg or Henson sort of a thing. So those are the ones we usually kind of made the effort and got a chance to see. So, you know, I remember seeing The Dark Crystal when I was about 6 or 7 years old and just changing my whole way of looking at everything.
Now, The Dark Crystal is very divisive for children, though, right? Because some of them find it very mystical and enchanting and some of them find it terrifying.
My wife said that movie scared the crap out of her when she was little. And I don't know. I just didn't take it that way when I was little.
Sucking the essence out of that podling, man. That's terrifying.
It still terrifies me, so...
But yeah, I don't know. I always kind of connected with that darker stuff. And, you know, a lot of my experience with movies when I was really young was reading about movies, you know? So it was like, I read about the Boris Karloff Frankenstein. I read about the Bela Lugosi Dracula and the Wolfman, Invisible Man, and all of those kind of things. I would read about them in these little books that you can get from the Scholastic. I don't know if you remember.
Like the book fair coming through.
Yeah, they give you these catalogs at school, and you can kind of pick out the things. You know, I always kind of picked the stuff that was a little on the darker side. discovered Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that way, and discovered, you know, was reading about all these movies a bunch and just, you know, just like ogling the just like the one still image they would have from a movie.
Wow.
So movies were it was a really special thing, you know. And I was really into comic books by the time I was in elementary school, and thought I was going to write and draw comic books and tried to teach myself to draw. And then by the time I ended up in middle school, I kind of realized that I just didn't have a gift for drawing. I was honest with myself about that. And then I met a friend that had a video camera, and we made our own little Nightmare on Elm Street movie. And just ever since then, that's all I wanted to do.
Oh, wait, we need to break down this Nightmare on Elm Street remake shot for shot. I want to hear everything. This is my favorite horror movie. Please.
It was just me and one other kid. And he was kind of a gateway to horror for me, because he had all the cool posters. He had like the Squirm poster up in his room.
Nice.
He had like the soundtrack to like Day of the Dead and all these things that made like this really big impression on me. And I had already kind of really, really kind of gotten into the Freddy movies, the first three Nightmare on Elm Street films, are still really, really special to me, those films. And that idea of being able to show someone dreams, you know, or nightmares. I just thought that was really exciting. So yeah, the first thing that we made was our own little Freddy movie, and we made like got latex and made a mask, you know, stuck all this stuff to my face and shot like our own little Freddy movie on one of those old video cameras that, I mean, this camera was old even when we were playing with it. It was like one of the first video cameras where it's like a camera that has a cable connected to it, and you got to carry a VCR around with you in order to.
Oh my gosh.
Dedication.
He had aimed it at the sun at a certain point, so like the lens was burnt out on it. Yeah, but shortly after that, I got a job at a horse ranch, shoveling horse shit and feeding racehorses. And that money that I made that summer is what paid for my first video camera, and I've been making movies ever since.
So, how old were you doing that?
11.
So, oh my gosh.
So this Nightmare on Elm Street film that you made, was it like a shot for shot of the movie, or you made your own?
It was totally our own creation. And this was Dream Warriors was the only movie that was out up to that. That was the newest one. Uh-huh. I think we called it ours was called the Dream Child.
Oh.
And they ended up making one called Dream Child later on. We were just like, we were there first.
Yeah, they stole your idea. You could get him for that IP. That's hilarious.
Ours was that I was like Freddy's like twisted son or something like that. I think that was the kind of idea of ours.
Does it still exist anywhere?
You know what? I've got to have it somewhere. I just would have to look through a mountain, you know, find the old box with the old VHS tapes in it.
Yes, you got to save that. Gold. You got to get that probably digital.
So what would you say? So you mentioned Nightmare on Elm Street as being some formative movies. Are there any other movies that come from that time period that you feel like were the formative films that you still look back on with that same fondness?
Yeah, a couple years before that, my sister, you know, before we owned a VCR, this is back in like the early mid 80s. Before we had a VCR, we would get to rent a VCR for our birthday and a couple mm-hmm. movies that would come with this package that you could rent from the video store. So we rented a VCR, and one of our cousins at my sister's birthday convinced her to rent a bunch of horror movies. So she rented Psycho 3.
Okay.
Carrie and the Hitcher, and we watched all three of those movies just one dark night in our house in the middle of nowhere, in this dark house. And it was me, and I was always around girls growing up. All of my cousins were girls. I had one sibling, it was my older sister, so I was with two girl cousins that were a couple years older than me, and then my sister, and we sat down and we watched these movies, and it just opened up a whole new world to me. It was so fun to be scared and so fun. You know, The Hitcher is a phenomenal film.
It doesn't get a lot of love, but it really is. Like the tension in that movie is fantastic. Man.
So damn scary, and so many things made a big impression on me. And then Carrie, obviously, you know, had a huge impact on me. And even Psycho 3 really freaked us out. So so yeah, I mean, that was those were really, really formative movies for me.
And you obsessed over Freddy Krueger and then later got to work with Robert Englund. What was that? That must have been mind-blowing.
It was a lifelong dream fulfilled, you know. Not only was I a huge fan of what he had done with Wes Craven, but I was also a huge fan of this show V that he had been on.
Oh yeah.
Kid, he played this character Willie on V that was like this dirty alien I saw V before I saw Nightmare on Elm Street, so I just always really liked him as an actor, you know. And he had worked with my friend Toby Hooper on one of his first films, and there was a lot of really good connections there. And yeah, I mean, it was totally surreal to get to direct that guy for a day. It was amazing, and he's such a joy to be around, you know. He's so knowledgeable about film and just so excited about what we all get to do still, you know.
Oh, that's so good to hear.
That's so nice to hear. Yeah.
He's a wonderful person. So.
So what would you say as a horror buff is your scariest in your opinion?
Yeah.
The scariest movie?
Yes. Yeah, the scariest movie you've ever seen.
Might not be like the scariest movie for real, but the scariest movie to you in your world.
Yeah, I mean, of all time, I still think it's all about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Me too.
I don't think anybody has matched what that movie did. You know, I mean, it's inspired a lot of great movies, but there is just something really, really special that Toby was able to capture there in such a beautiful, artful way. You know, I mean, you can look at Texas Chainsaw Massacre next to something like Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon and see connections between those two films and the way they're shot. And there's just something, there's just really just the most excellent filmmaking you can imagine. And also this, I really connect with that film because it's about people in rural areas and just how scary it can get out there, you know, when you're isolated.
Did you feel that? Was that?
Oh yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I grew up in environments like that, you know? So.
Wow.
And
you put them on film.
Yeah. It was very, very believable to me. You know, it felt within the realm of possibility, and that, you know, that was why Jack Ketchum and I had a really good, you know, really good connection too, is that he really, you know, his whole obsession was the human monster. There's nothing scarier than people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's why he didn't delve into the fantastic realm very much. I like the fantastic. I like getting fantastic, and I like giving a fairy tale edge to stuff that I work on and stuff. But when I work with Ketchum, it was always a challenge to try to bring him into more fantastic creative spaces like we did with our dog book.
That's so interesting to have that kind of push-pull, right? Because then you have to meet somewhere in the middle, which I think is probably the sweet spot, right?
Yeah, with him it was. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Jack Ketchum and Toby Hooper both were critical mentors for me, you know, in my
Can you talk about how you met them and your relationship?
Ketchum, I met my buddy Chris Severson had discovered his writing because Stephen King was singing his praises and started picking up some of his books and tossing some of them my way. The first one I had a real connection with was Red. Then Chris was really enamored with The Lost. And when I got my first job, my first big job after I made May, I got this job directing this film for United Artists called The Woods. And I was actually getting paid to make a movie for the first time, which was kind of incredible. I had money and I bought Chris an option on The Lost, and I bought myself an option on another Ketchum novella called The Passenger, which I still would like to make. And through the course of that, I ended up meeting Ketchum and we just kind of hit it off. He really liked May. We became friends, and then I produced The Lost when Chris finally got that together. There was a lot of Ketchum, you know, I just really, really connected with a lot of the stuff he was writing, the kind of characters he was writing and the kind of situations. And we just became really good friends. And by the time the opportunity came up to do a sequel to this movie Offspring that had been made, I came to the table. I came to Ketchum with this idea for a way to continue that story with the woman, and our writing relationship was born there. We decided to do the book and the script together. And then we ended up writing three novels and some short stories, and, you know, just had this really kind of wonderful, 10, 12 year period where we were collaborating with each other. I really miss him. He was a wonderful, wonderful person. I learned a lot from him. And Toby, I met at a pool party sometime after I made May. And we just, a writer friend of mine was having a pool party, and Toby was there and Bill Moseley was there. And, you know, it was like, holy shit, you know, these guys are like icons to me. And I ended up talking to Toby and we just hit it off. You know, he kind of came from kind of similar background that I came from. And we had similar sensibilities about the way you make films and the way you treat people when you make films. He just started inviting me over to his house, and I'd go, you could only go to Toby's house after dark, after the sun went down. And
oh, why only after dark?
He was very much a nocturnal creature. So I would go over there and we would, you know, we'd sit down and have a cigarette or a coffee or something like that. And just talk about, you know, he was grilling me about what I was experiencing, giving me advice about that. And then also sharing old war stories with me about stuff he'd experienced. And then we would always end up watching a film together. He showed me his film Eggshells, which was his movie he made before Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And this was before you could get anybody had seen it, you know?
Wow.
Exciting.
What was that like?
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. It's a beautiful time capsule of Austin in the, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. But then, you know, obviously we would just like, you know, like he showed me Black Narcissus for the first time, this amazing Michael Powell and Emmett Pressburger film. And we would always, you know, we'd watch, you know, so I'd share with him a rough cut that I was working on, or he'd show me something he was working on, or we'd just watch some classic, because he always had like the best like audio visual gear. You know, he had like a 90 inch like HD TV, and we would just sit there and just watch movies and talk, and just he was just a wonderful person. He helped me so much.
That sounds like a literal dream. Like
it was, yeah. You, trying to take a step outside the situation, just going like, "How is this happening right now? You know, how did I look out? You know,
that's your real life. Your real life.
Yeah. It's really special. I cherish those memories. I miss that's him so... too. You know, and I lost both Toby and Ketchum within about a 6 month period, Toby passed away the day I brought my first child home from the hospital.
Oh, wow.
I was going through this tremendous feeling of becoming a father. And at the same time that I had just lost kind of like this mentor father figure kind of in the business. So it was this real, real kind of war of emotions going on through me at that time. And then, about four or five months after that, Ketchum passed away. So it was a trip to become a dad and then be losing these father figures, these mentors, you know, all
right.
The time was really overwhelming emotionally, you know.
It's like that circle, but that makes sense as I'm thinking about your new movie and just like circle of life and young and old and everything in between. I think that perfect theme. Wow. Lucky. I'm just going to say you're the luckiest. and lucky that that's your real name too. What a life. What a life to get to hang out with these legends. So cool. I want to know, I guess, in between making a movie at like 11 years old and getting to make professional movies, what was kind of like the genesis, or did you go to film school, or what happened to be in between these times?
Was also, you know, obviously a huge fan of George Lucas and Jim Henson and guys like that. And Lucas grew up about an hour from where I grew up. He grew up in the Modesto area. So that was really inspiring to me. It's like, wow, you can come from a place like this and go on to, you know, to make movies.
Yeah.
And you know, at the time in high school, I also was really, you know, just enamored, and my life was changed by Nirvana. And that was kind of a similar thing where it was like these scrubby guys that come from a similar environment came from, you know, all of a sudden are like on Saturday Night Live or on MTV or in doing their thing and doing this kind of like raw, honest art. I was very inspired by, you know, by Lucas, and that led me to USC, which is where he went to school. And a lot of filmmakers that I was learning about had gone to that school. So I was like, well, okay, I'll try to go to USC. And I managed to get into the screenwriting program there.
What?
Undergrad.
That's a hard program to get into.
I didn't realize that at the time. I actually went for the screenwriting program instead of the, I wanted to go to the production school, which is, you know, more hands-on filmmaking, but I decided to go for the screenwriting program and got in, and then kind of realized later that it was actually harder to get into the screenwriting.
Yes, that's so competitive.
Yeah, they only took 24 kids a year from around the world, you know. But I managed to get in, so I had a tremendous experience there. I mean, I met so many of the people that I still work with today, and I'm still are my dearest friends. I met Zach Passero there, who edits all of my films. Chris Sievertson, who I've made many films with.
Yes.
Ryan Johnson and Steve Yedlin, who shot May for me and has gone on to shoot all of Ryan's movies, like Knives Out.
I'm getting like goosebumps for that. That is wild. Like
this amazing group of people that just all ended up on the same dorm floor because we all expressed an interest in cinema. We ended up on this themed floor in the dorms called the cinema floor. And I'm still friends with all those people I met when I was 17 years old. And we still work together and still help each other on each other's projects. And I learned how, you know, I kind of found my voice. I went into film school thinking I wanted to make things like Star Wars or The Dark Crystal or something. And I came out of college wanting to make stuff like Taxi Driver or Reservoir Dogs or Repulsion. You know, I really found my voice, and I wrote May there and my junior year, and made my first short films and kind of started to learn how to direct I mean, USC was so valuable, not because of the school itself or the professors or anything like that. It was really just my peers, you know.
It's the people. It's the network, for sure.
This amazing band of just weirdos and geniuses that I met, you know, and you know, we're still all really tight to this day. And I'd written that May script, and you know, like I said, I finished it my junior year of college, and a kid that was in the graduate school had read it at that time and was really into it and was trying to help me even get it made when I was still in film school. And nothing came of it. And then 2 years after I graduated, I got a call from him from out of the blue, and he said he was starting a production company. And he said, I still think, you know, do you still want to make that movie? And I was like, hell yes. And, you know, they brought me down to LA, and we just developed it and figured out how to get it made. So,
oh my gosh, how long did it take from that moment on to like get it done?
It went pretty fast. I mean, we kind of developed it and cast and put all the pieces together over the course of a year. I came down to LA and got a day job and crashed on Chris Sievertson's couch and worked in an internet company shooting and cutting videos of celebrities and stuff like that, which was hilarious.
God, I can't even imagine you doing that.
Solid gold. That. And then we finally got May made about a year later. We shot it, and then about a year later we were in Sundance, and that was it. I suddenly had a career.
Oh my gosh, what was your first Sundance like?
Nerve-wracking. I mean, I could barely stand up. I was so nervous, you know. I have a stage fright that's been kind of reared its head when I was in middle school that I, you know, had been trying to shake ever since. So the idea of standing up in front of people and even introducing my film was terrifying to me. So, that was all trial by fire. I had to learn how to do that stuff. I mean, even us talking right now, I mean, like I would get my, like 20 years ago, I would get myself so worked up that I could barely even talk, you know. I was just so nervous. And I'm not like that when I make a film, though. When I make a film, I just feel totally comfortable and I feel totally like myself, and I have no problem standing in front of a crew of 50 people or 100 people or whatever and saying, this is what we should be doing. And it's really strange, but in that social setting of like a film festival and all of that was just really, really hard on my nerves. You know, I just had no idea how people were going to take this weird little personal movie I made, you know, and then once I started hearing them laughing, and that they weren't laughing at the movie.
Yeah, the good laughs.
They were laughing out of this intense feeling of discomfort the movie was making them feel. I was like, okay, well, you know, maybe this will work, you know? And it's just gotten easier over the years to deal with all of those emotions and kind of wrestle them back, you know?
That is so wild to me. I am always fascinated by artists and how they interact with the public, or how we interact with like introducing our art. And I commend you for like, I don't know, the journey you've been on, because I wouldn't have no idea speaking with you today that that was even an issue for you, because it's just so easy to chat with you.
I mean, there's this really kind of schizophrenic lifestyle that you live, because you're very much, especially if you're writing the script yourself, it's all you in the page, and it's very intimate. And then you go, then you're thrust into making the film, and it's just this huge amount of personalities and activity and all this stuff. And you get really caught up in that storm. And then you go into post, and it's just you and the editor, and it's very intimate again, and it's very quiet. And then all of a sudden you have to go into this press thing and this social thing. And it's just, you know, it's just a constant back and forth of like, you know, really, really social and a lot of people and a lot of activity to something like very small and intimate. So it's like, if you know, at that time, if somebody had interviewed me while I was in the middle of making the movie, I would have been much more articulate, and I would have been, you know, but after this, you know, spending like 6 months in the editing room or whatever, you know, you just get into this like caveman mentality.
Lived a hermit lifestyle. Maybe you're not ready to talk to people. Maybe you don't want somebody coming up to your cabin and bothering you. Oh my goodness. We haven't even talked about, like, I feel like some of your other films too. I want to talk like a few minutes about The Woman.
Yeah.
Just because that's a movie that we've covered here on the show that we were both really floored by. And I would love to know, I guess, that was something you guys also adapted from something you wrote originally, I believe, as a novel. Is that right?
I was, you know, Ketchum and I broke that story together. I brought an idea to the table, which was, you know, pretty clean, simple idea, which was, look, if, you know, the woman was the kind of the villain in the previous film, I'd like to kind of turn that upside down and make her kind of, you know, the protagonist of the next film and the person that whose side you're ultimately on. And that was really interesting to him. So we broke the story and came up with the whole way the story would work, but we actually wrote the screenplay first. I did the heavy lifting on that because we knew we were going to get to make the movie. It was a done deal. It was like, you know, we were getting paid to develop this as a film, and you know, we were, you know, decided to, you know, do the novel as well, because it's like, why not? Because he had done two novels in this world previous, Off Season and Off Spring. So that was, you know, this literary career kind of, you know, was this wonderful byproduct to getting that film made. But yeah, that was a really, really intense movie to make. I don't know that I could make a movie like that now. I'm now
really
married.
Why? What's the difference?
I'm married now. I'm a dad. I'm a lot more sensitive about really that movie has a lot of anger in it, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of kind of screaming into the void just about just how awful people were. And I was feeling really beat up at that point in my career. And I just was like, look, if you want a horror movie, I'm going to give you a horror movie, but it's going to be about people, you know? And like, and just that, you know, just how men can be and how humans in general can be, just, you know, having their, you know, if they have any kind of advantage over another person, how they leverage that against them. And
yeah.
That's just really terrifying stuff to me, you know.
So. That is terrifying, but unfortunately, I feel like the theme of that one keeps coming back the most, especially just within, you know, the world we happen to be in right now, just different laws and things being enacted and whatnot. So I just feel like that one ever seems ever present in my mind to me, and so I think that's a big part of it. And why I probably still love it and think about it like every other day. It's one of those movies that just lives in my mind.
Yeah. I'm glad I made it, but that was a hard headspace to live in for a couple of years. You know?
I'm sure.
It was hard to write. It was hard to shoot.
What was it like with Polly?
Emotionally. I mean, she handled it way better than I did. the rape scene, for instance, I mean, that was much harder for me to shoot than it was for her, because she was in the mentality of her character that this doesn't mean anything to her. It doesn't doesn't mean the same thing it would mean to you or me if that was happening to us, because she's much closer to that primal, you know, animal that's inside of all of us. And she's much more like, you know, the way an animal would deal with something like that emotionally, or a cave, you know, like she's like a cave woman, really.
Yeah, totally. A first woman.
didn't have the emotional weight or baggage with her. It was just like, okay, you know, so she was in an okay emotional place. But for me, I was just like, I was totally fucking traumatized shooting that. You know, you ask yourself, why am I doing this again? You know, when you're in the middle of doing that stuff. And, but that's what keeps you from, you know, falling into pure exploitation, I think, you know, like being, you know, thinking of how to handle that kind of stuff, because that stuff does exist, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I thought you did a really nice job. And I was actually like, one of those things I don't, sometimes when we watch movies, we don't read anything. We try to read as little about them as possible before we watch them, just so we don't have any like type of clouding. But I was like, oh my God, I was like, I kept being like, a guy directed this, but yeah, it feels still like a feminist like film. So good job.
I've had people tell me that. I mean, I don't think that, you know, I mean, I think any of this stuff, it's like, if you're dealing with really touchy subject matter, you just make sure that you're surrounded by good moral people, you know, that are asking you the tough questions, and you know, it's all about being able to look yourself in the mirror at the end of every day, you know. So I was very careful with the way I handled anything in terms of the actual filming process with children, because there's children in the film.
Yeah.
And how we pieced that out in a way to where kids weren't a part of anything that was too inappropriate. You know, it was a delicate thing making that film.
That's heartening to hear. I really appreciate it. That's awesome. Well, Lucky, we have a new movie to talk about today. Yes. That you have brought to us. Yeah. And we would love to know, I guess, about the genesis of that. Julia, are you on here?
Yes.
We have not talked about Deathcember. You can talk, please.
Oh, hi, I'm back. Sorry about that. That was quite a brief. Anyway. Hey, so Lucky, we are part of the same film in a way.
Oh, no shit.
I am in Deathcember.
Oh, really?
Yes. I am in Michael Verratti's segment, All Sales Fatal.
Oh,
and no. So here we are. Look at that. What a connection.
Shared credits.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. I saw that new edition that is coming out through Vinegar Syndrome and
yep.
Fun City, I think, is the name of the label. But I was really excited about that. I can't wait to get
it. Do you have the VHS copy? Because I have a VHS copy.
Yeah, I do. They also that same company did a VHS of The Woman.
That's amazing. Do you still have a VCR? Could this be watched?
I do. Yeah, of course I still have a VCR. I'm a child.
All right, that's the correct answer. That's what I'm talking about.
He's right in the same wheelhouse, I think, age wise as us too, Julia. So of course he's got all the dead media as well.
Yeah, I was born in 1975, so I've been around.
Yep. yay, Luddites of Hollywood. I'd love to talk about Deathcember a little bit too before we hop to Old Man, if that's okay too, because I am obsessed with this short, because I also love westerns, and I'm just like, I think that's why I love your movies so much too. They have this western spaghettiness about them, but this movie is so good. They once had horses.
Yeah, that was really special. You know, I never saw myself doing anything like that, and my friend Charles Horak, who I do producing work with here in El Paso, had a notion of an idea for that. And I took to it and, you know, saw it as an opportunity to team back up with Sean Bridgers and also team up with my friend Justin Stone, who's the guy playing across Sean. And I'm a huge fan of Sam Peckinpah and certain specific westerns from over time. It's not a genre I'm super well versed in, but it was like, but I know how good old boys talk. I grew up around a lot of people like that, and I lived a lot in rural Northern California and rural Oklahoma, so I really kind of had an ear for that kind of dialogue. So that was just a pleasure to make, and also to get to shoot something in black and white, which I've been really wanting to do with a feature for a while. But my buddy
Charles, how was it shooting knowing it was going to be black and white? Was it, you know, because then you have to worry about the light being different than you would in the color.
It's all about, you know, black to white and grayscales and contrast and all that kind of stuff. I had a great DP in Ryan Orozco, and that was pretty easy to crack. And my friend Charles, his father owned like thousands of acres out in the desert here in El Paso, and had beautiful like canyons on this property of his. And me and about six or seven other people went out there and just pulled an all-nighter in the middle of the night in this canyon and shot this little thing. Hauling the gear out. Yeah, in one night. Yeah.
And oh, wow.
Hauling all that gear out of that at the end of the day was definitely a time when I turned to my friend Zach Passero, who you know, he worked as an electrician on it and camera assistant, and obviously he edits all of my stuff. But it was a very, very small group of us that went out there. But it was when we were unloading that equipment at the end of the day and walking it through this rocky terrain, I was like, man, I've officially gotten too old for this shit. All the time when we were, you know, in our 20s and everything, you know, man, I was really feeling it at the end of that night. It was when you there's no flat ground to stand on for 12 hours. It's, and just a constant ankle twisting possibilities happening.
Oh no.
But thankfully nobody got hurt or anything, and we just had a wonderful time out there shooting that.
Well, I love that you kind of go all over the place genre-wise with your films, and you have such a variety of the different kinds of interactions with humans. I think that's really interesting, which segues nicely into your new film, Old Man, which comes out this year, 2022, in October. The tagline is "Beware the Enemy Within." Yeah. And this was written by Joel Veitch. So tell us how this all came about, if you would be so kind.
This came about through Mark Center. I had as I said before, I had bought the option for The Lost so Chris could make that movie, and Mark was the star of The Lost, the first Jack Ketchum adaptation, mm-hmm. Film adaptation. And Mark and I, you know, became really, really close friends over the course of making that movie. And we, of course, always wanted to work as actor and director. Our first opportunity was on this anthology film called Tales of Halloween. We made this mm-hmm. little short called Ding Dong about this couple that can't have a kid that on Halloween night, and all these children are showing up at their door, and the kind of raw emotions that kind of pulls out of them. But we'd never
That's
had
amazing.
We'd never had that full meal of doing a feature. And Mark had gotten into the producing game, and he happened upon this script that an old friend of his had written and brought it to me. And he was like, this could be the one. I was like, yeah, you know, I connected with it right out of the gate. I knew this old man. I was raised by men like this. My grandfather ended up living in a little cabin in the middle of nowhere in Oklahoma at the end of his life. So I knew this kind of guy, and I felt like Joel had written it from a very honest, non-judgmental place, which is something that I try to do in anything that I make. I try not to be judgmental of my characters. I try to just show them for who they are, good or bad. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of realized over the course of talking about the movie, doing press the last week or so, that this movie does really, really speak to a big fear of mine, which is ending up like that. Am I going to end up like my grandfather or my dad, just living in a cabin in the middle of nowhere, you know, because of burning too many people or making the wrong decisions or any of that stuff? And I kind of realized that over kind of talking to the film, now that people are finally seeing it, you know, kind of realized that maybe that's why I had such a connection with it, you know? Hmm.
And was the script, because there's so much going on in this movie that's not dialogue. And so how did the script describe even the first shot of what his emotions are?
Well, the script was adapted from, Joel had adapted it from a play that he had written, had never gotten up, when it finally became, honestly, it's the pandemic that made this movie really happen, because all of a sudden, like, I'd been floating around it for a couple of years. Yeah, you know, maybe we can go knock that out in a little window of time here between this other thing I'm doing. But when the pandemic happened, it became like, this is the perfect movie to make during the pandemic. Yeah. You know,
mm-hmm. Right size cast, everything.
Yeah. And it's you know, the scale is what it is, and it's one location, and it's two actors, and we can make it with a relatively small crew. And with the pandemic happening, we got a lot of resources that we wouldn't have gotten pre-pandemic, the soundstage that we ended up with. They're just nobody, you know, that was typically loaded to the gills with big HBO shows and movies and stuff like that. But like nobody was making anything at that time. And we took the risk and we did all of the COVID precautions and nobody ended up getting sick. But
that's great.
But it just seemed like the perfect thing to make. But about a month before we went into prep on the film, Joel and I sat down, we would sit down over Zoom for a month straight, just going over every single inch of the script and trying to take it out of that theatrical space and bring it into a more cinematic space. Like the third act is where some of the biggest changes we made took place, where a lot of what happens in the third act was just explained in dialogue. Just, you know, everything was kind of spelled out, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to do something that was much more in a visual kind of open to interpretation sort of a tip. And Joel really liked that and did a great job kind of getting the script to where it ended up.
Well, for me, and Terry can attest, my favorite kinds of movies are two people talking in a room.
She's like, yeah, honestly, dinner with Andre Stan. Like, she's like the biggest My Dinner with Andre fan. So that kind of thing.
Yeah. There's a really good Polanski movie called Carnage. I mean, I hate to even mention that man's name because he's such a terrible person. But Carnage is a really, really interesting film in that regard. Ooh. Single location.
I haven't heard of that one because
it's Kate Winslet, John C. Reilly, Christoph Waltz.
All you had to say was Kate Winslet and she sold, because like honestly Heavenly Creatures is like one of our favorite movies as anything with her, we're good. That sounds great.
Heavenly Creatures, masterpiece.
I mean, for me, I guess I feel like cinema is about the characters, right? You can have spectacle, and spectacle is what it is, but if I don't care about the characters, none of it matters. So for me, you just strip away everything that's, for me, superfluous about a film and just get to the meat of it. That's what I want. So this was giving me everything I wanted. I was like, yes.
Yeah, and that's what was very exciting to me, because I've kind of realized, you know, over the course of my career, the most important thing to me is character. It's like, yeah, I have worked in a lot of genre is secondary to me. It's a character. It's really about these portraits that we're painting of people, you know, and my wife is an illustrator and portrait artist. And I've become really conscious of that in my own work, that film can work as portraiture. So Old Man is very much a portrait of an old man's mind, you know.
And there was actually a lot of the visuals looked like an actual portrait to me. There was a still of them sitting at the table by the window that I was like, oh, it's a Renaissance painting. Like this is exactly.
Yeah. And our biggest influence in terms of painters was this painter, Andrew Wyeth, who's really, really famous for his painting Christina's World, which is the girl, in the field of wheat, looking at this house up in the distance, and the closer you start to realize that maybe there's something wrong with her bones, or she's sick or something like that. But that painter, Andrew Wyeth, had done a lot of beautiful paintings of kind of old men sitting in, you know, just trashed cabins, you know, like, or like laying kind of these sad portraits of old men. A lot of African American men, in a lot of these paintings he had done. So that was a huge jumping off point for us. I mean, some of the walls in that set that we built are just straight out of Andrew Wyeth paintings, because of something about those dilapidated environments said a lot to me dramatically, you know.
Well, there is that, you know, the Japanese idea of wabi-sabi, right? This kind of beauty in decay and destruction.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's a big thing with David Lynch, too. Another big hero of mine.
Julia's, too. This is definitely a kismet moment. She's a super David Lynch super fan as well. So
He's such an inspiration. His work is so pure, you know?
Do you feel that he... as filmmaker, do you feel that he understands all of it, or does he let it be as dreamlike as we interpret it?
I think he understands a lot more than he lets on, you know, but he understands that there's great power in mystery. You know, there's great power in not crossing every T and dotting every I, because when you do that and you leave things open, you give the audience the ability to make their own personal interpretation of something. And that can make a work of art much more personal to the viewer.
Yep.
So, I mean, even with Old Man, I have my interpretation of what's actually transpiring in the movie, but Stephen Lang has a different interpretation. And Mark Snyder has a different interpretation of what's actually.
Do we get to know?
Well, Stephen Lang is convinced that the old man is just laying in a hospital bed somewhere.
That was my thought.
Or something like
really?
That. You know? I thought he was like having a dream and he was someplace else and this is like all in his mind.
Yeah.
And I was like, he's someplace else. He's not even up there. Like there's like no way he could have made it up there. He's just going through like that regret in his life. Then at one point I was like, oh, maybe he's just like a ghost and this is like a memory play for a ghost.
Yeah. I'll keep my interpretation to myself, but you know, because it's very personal. It just means certain things to me, you know. None of those are right or wrong though, you know. We tried to, like I said, leave that door open for the audience. So they would, you know, because the very final note in the movie is an invitation to watch the movie over again. Because I think once you've gone through it the first time and you realize, you know, you learn all the things you learn, when you go back and watch it a second time, it's going to be a totally different film. You're gonna realize that there's a lot of brick building and a lot of foundation laid to sell that ending, you know.
I think those kind of movies are so fun.
Yeah.
That you really do want to go back and kind of immediately watch it over and look at it. You can see the movie with fresh eyes twice, really.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden it looks a little, you know, a line here or there all of a sudden has a completely different meaning, you know, that second time around, which is really exciting to me. You know, one thing that I realized I hadn't talked to anybody about yet is that my sound designer, I can't remember if it was my sound designer, I think it was his idea, or maybe our composer, Joe Kramer, but we had this idea, we had this singer who sings this song at the end titles, AJ Lambert. She's part of the Sinatra family. Her grandfather is Sinatra. Her mom is Nancy Sinatra.
Oh.
And then she's this powerful kind of musical voice in her own right. So we did, you know, we did that kind of ending theme song that she wrote based on Joe's score. And then my sound designer was like, what if we get her, you know, in my recording booth and just record her breathing over the entire movie? So the next time you look at the film, really, really kind of hone in on the soundtrack, you realize you hear a woman breathing the entire time the movie is.
Oh, wow.
Oh my gosh.
Creates this presence, you know, that really makes sense once the whole film reveals it to itself and what's really torturing this old man and everything.
I was just
so excited by that. Oh my God. I was just going to say lucky. That's fucking rad. That is rad.
But I'd never heard of anything like that, you know, and like her the pace of her breath picks up when things get tense and she sighs and it's really, really cool.
Feeds the theory though that he's in bed and then there's like somebody sitting next to him, you know what I mean, though, like in the room, like could totally feed into that theory. I love that so much. Oh my gosh. But I also don't feel like it's bad that old men end up out in the woods sometimes if like they can't handle what's going on in the rest of the world. Like I don't think that, like, I think sometimes you need that time of, I guess, reflection and respite maybe, and I don't think it's always a terrible thing that they go out and, you know, enjoy a quiet space.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. I don't know if I agree with that.
Maybe that's probably from the world right now. We were just talking earlier, Julia, just like, I think while you were offline for a second, like about like just having a quiet space in the midst of like the mayhem of the world right now wouldn't be a bad move. So
yeah, but even like the worst misanthrope still should be around people. But yeah. I think that's what humans are made to be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's because, you know, a big part of the problems that we have in this country is because there are a lot of people that are very isolated from the real world, you know,
right.
Different types of people, different ways of living, different types of culture, all of those things. If you grew up in the types of places I grew up, it's a very, very insulated world and it's very easy to fall into the way things work in that little part of the world, and then everything outside of that is alien and foreign and you're afraid of it and you become hateful of it and all that kind of stuff. And that's really what happens, you know, this separation between people that live in the country and that type of way of life and thinking, and then people that live in the city that that really are confronted with all the variety of our planet, you know, on a daily basis, you know. It's a big part of why we have such a big divide in this country, I think.
Yeah.
But with the old man, you know, in terms of, you know, showing him in an honest way, I mean, there was concern at a certain point. He makes a comment about women and how you can't trust them and all of this mm-hmm. kind of stuff. There was a lot of concern from our producing team at a certain point that we shouldn't say that because we'll offend people and it'll piss them off. And I was like, we have to say it. That's how these guys talk. You know, yeah, it would be to cut that out and to show that that's his point of view. And, you know, this isn't about him being a hero or somebody that we love or anything like that. It's about painting a portrait of a real person that exists, you know? So that was a point of contention at a certain point. And fortunately I had Final Cut and that was the end of that.
I'm glad that's in there because it is confrontational. But I feel like we've all heard people say that, like say yeah. those things out loud.
Absolutely, you know, and that goes into the same, you know, the same approach that I took to the woman is like, look, this kind of behavior exists, you know. Right. If you start to, you know, prettify it or smooth over the rough edges or whatever, it's not genuine anymore, you know.
And so how did you get connected with Stephen Lang and working with him?
The typical casting process. I mean, obviously, you know, Mark brought me the material because he really wanted to play the Joe character. So once, you know, the movie started to become a real boy, so to speak, we went through lists of actors and everything, and Slang's name came up on the list, and I'd known my friend Joe Bigos had worked with him on VFW, so I knew that there was somebody I could call.
Oh yeah, nice.
What was it like working with him? Is he a dick?
Good questions to ask.
Joe's film was a low budget film too, you know.
But his films have all been fantastic.
Joe's awesome. He's definitely got his own thing going on. He's made some really cool shit. He's getting mm-hmm. better and better too. I think VFW and Bliss is really spectacular. He put in a really good word for Slang. And then I met Steven over the phone, and we really hit it off, and I kind of realized, wow, this guy, he's not jaded. He's been doing this for 50 years and he's not jaded. He actually still really loves this stuff.
He loves the work. You can tell.
Really deep roots in theater, you know, mm-hmm. which was a big asset for a piece of material like this. He could do a 12-minute uninterrupted take of dialogue and not miss a beat, you know?
Yeah, sure. You do Shakespeare on stage. It's going to be hours and hours of it, right?
Yeah. So,
and had you directed plays before?
No, I've never had anything to do with the theater. It's totally foreign to me. I have great respect for it, and I love working with actors that have that experience because they don't just memorize the scenes for the day on the day. They memorize a whole script, and they have they beat everything out in like their, you know, these spectacular ways. They really map out their performances because they're used to having to do all of that in one night. You know?
You got your arc, you've got everything. Yep.
Yep. Yeah. So they really know how to plug in, you know. And Angela Bettis was really good that way. I mean, her whole May performance, you know, and we had to shoot completely out of order on May, obviously. So she could be, you know, the timid girl at the beginning of the movie, or like the sleek, hard, you know, emotionless killer at the end, you know, switching back and forth on a given day.
Wow.
The thing that was cool about Old Man is we got to shoot pretty much in script order because the movie is pretty real time, which I probably would be the only time I'll ever get to do that. We only had to jump ahead like about a week and a half into shooting. We had to jump ahead because of an actor's schedule. We had to jump ahead and shoot the flashback stuff. But then mm-hmm. we got to go back and do everything in linear order, which was really cool for the actors and really cool for me. But yeah, Stephen Lang is just a delight. He's a grade A ball buster too, you know.
Oh my god, do tell.
The best, most good-natured way. Oh my god, he gave Mark Center such a hard time in the best possible way, though, like in a way that just like kept Mark, you know, on his game and everything. It was hilarious, you know. He's a really funny guy, you know. And he's got this no bullshit and no ego kind of air about him, and he was just fucking hilarious to work with. It's just a joy. There's a reason he has 100 credits on his IMDb because he's just a joy to work with, you know.
I like that you asked about him though, and I think people don't realize that happens as much as
It happens all the time.
To ask another filmmaker friend about working with this person.
It's all about references. I give references out on actors and crew people all the time, you know, or like, you know what? I don't know if you and this person are going to fit, you know? I mean, there's good and bad to that too, but like I've kind of learned that I really encourage people to be very honest with me because I want to know what's coming, you know? Is this person going to have a problem? Or, you know, are they going to fit with my kind of approach to things, which is this very like, I'm really excited about what I'm doing, you know, and I want people that I'm working with to be really excited about what they're doing. And I want to work with people that realize that this is a privilege that we get to do this stuff. And then it's fun that we get to make believe for a living, you know, and when
it's
you work
a miracle.
With you, Yeah. And when you work with jaded people, it's just so fucking depressing. You know, it's like, I just don't understand people that are content to be miserable.
No. And it's interesting how every different crew has a different personality in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So we have a question. Terry, is it time for our question?
Yes, let's do some questions, Julia.
Okay, so the question we have is, now normally we do specifically your movie, but if we would like to give a general tip, we will take that as well. As Horror Movie Survival Guide, our big question is, how do you survive this movie?
How do you survive Old Man?
Yeah.
It's a little harder, this one.
Really?
I mean, you can also give a general, like as Julia said, Horror Movie Survival Guide tip, because we have, you know, all the oeuvre of horror behind you, all the different films that you've watched. What's your best tip that you would say to survive, you know, a horror movie? But Old Man, that's a tough one.
Just don't go in the cabin would be the first thing. The
right?
First
thing I would say. But you are the cabin. How do you escape?
You're in the cabin. Boy, you know, and I think Joe does a pretty good job of kind of keeping the old man at bay over the course of that story. I mean, you got to find a way to get out of that cabin. That's really tough. I honestly don't have an answer for that. I don't know, because of the way the movie is constructed. It's very much in a kind of a psychological space, you know.
Once you're in, you're in. Yeah.
How do you escape your own thoughts, you know?
Yeah, and there's some movies that we watch where the answer is you can't survive. There's no way to do it.
In this case, I don't know that that's possible. You know, because it is a kind of limbo or a purgatory sort of a situation. You know. Mm-hmm.
Well, our Horror Movie Survival Guide tips are always don't go into the woods by yourself.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a big one. Yeah. Yep.
Don't make bad decisions that can't be
done. The best survival tip of all.
Kids, you heard it here. Don't make bad decisions. Just keep making the good ones and your life will be all right.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Oh, goodness.
Well, Lucky, thank you so much for coming to be with us today, talking about all your stuff. We're so grateful to you and appreciative and love talking to other people who love horror and film as much as we do.
Oh, man. Yeah. You guys are a pleasure to talk to. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, yeah. Where can people find you on the internet, Lucky? Can they follow you places? Where can they find you?
The easiest place to find me is on Twitter, at Lucky McKee. That's my one place. I have Instagram and all that kind of stuff, but Twitter is where you can find me and my wife, Vanessa McKee, who did all of the illustrations that are in the film.
Which are gorgeous.
The opening credit illustration is her and the storybook illustrations in the film. And there's even some drawings of my sons, who's 3 years old at the time, on the walls, kind of peppered around inside the old man's cabin and everything.
Oh, it's a family affair, you guys.
Yeah, exactly. Twitter's the best place to find the McKees.
We really loved Old Man, and we really would love everyone to watch it. So where can they find the film?
If you look on look on my Twitter page, RLJ, I just retweeted it, quote tweeted it. They just put out a list of all the theaters it's playing. It's playing in about 20 or 30 theaters across the states. And then
you'll see it in the theater. That's the best place to see it.
Yes.
Living in the type of environments I grew up in, that's living in that cabin in the middle of the woods, can find it on VOD. They can find it on iTunes and Amazon and Vudu and all of those places. You know, and then down the road, it'll be on, you know, it'll be on a streaming platform, and they're going to put a Blu-ray out and all that kind of stuff. So there'll be a lot of opportunities to see it. But as far as this Friday, there's those theaters that are listed on my Twitter page and VOD.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Lucky. It was so nice to meet you. You're so awesome.
Likewise.
Just a dream come true. You think I'm kidding. I'm super not. Like, we have been very big fans of yours for a very long time. So thank you again for hopping on. And thank you all for listening. You guys can catch us on the usual spots on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. If you want to support us on Patreon, it's still an independently produced show by a few ladies. Please support us. You can also get some merch if you so desire. Bags, totes, mugs, things like that at our Teespring store as well. That's linked to us through our website as well. Thank you again so much. We'll see you again real soon for another episode of Horror Movie Survival Guide. Thanks.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening. Horror Movie Survival Guide is independently produced by Terry Gamble, Julia Marchesi, and Sierra Ryan. Hey, that's me. If you would like to support the show, find us on patreon.com/horrormoviesurvivalguide.